There's a real grave danger to China, to Russia, to all nations.
South Korea and the United States begin annual joint military drills. It's Tuesday, December 5th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Canada and China talk trade. Australia has a big battery. Chinese and Japanese cuisine moving up the charts, replacing lymph nodes and cloud clothing. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The United States and South Korea have kicked off large joint aerial drills after North Korea denounced the exercises, saying the Trump administration is begging for nuclear war. Around 12,000 U.S. service personnel and 230 aircraft, including advanced F-22 and F-35 fighters, are taking part in 5 days of drills called Vigilant Ace. The exercises take place after last week's North Korean test of a new Hwasong-15 ballistic missile it said can reach anywhere in the United States with a nuclear warhead. White House National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster warned the potential for war with North Korea is increasing every day. McMaster, in an appearance Sunday on U.S. television, said the U.S. is prepared to do more to counter the threat, but added other countries need to do the same.
China, as you know, has taken some unprecedented actions. And what we're asking China to do is not to do us or anybody else a favor, but to act in China's interest. There's a real grave danger to China, to Russia, to all nations, you know, from North Korea that's armed with nuclear weapons. And of course, you have that direct threat, but you also have the threat of the potential of Japan, South Korea, others arming themselves, possibly even with nuclear weapons. That is not in China's interest. It's not in Russia's interest. As you know, this is a regime that's never met a weapon that it hasn't proliferated. It's a regime who said what its intentions are. Its intentions are to use that weapon for nuclear blackmail and then to, quote, you know, reunify the peninsula under the Red Banner. The other really grave concern is the concern that he would proliferate or sell off these weapons to others. There's never been a weapon system that North Korea has developed that it hasn't sold to somebody else.
McMaster said he believes the North Korean threat is the most destabilizing development in the post-World War II era. Appearing on a separate program, Senate Armed Services Committee member Lindsey Graham said U.S. policy is to deny North Korea the ability to strike the United States with a nuclear weapon. He said the idea of a preemptive strike is becoming more real as the North's technology improves. He says any underground test would likely result in a serious U.S. response. Ralph Kosa, president of the Hawaii-based Pacific Forum Security Think Tank, tells VOA's Victor Beatty while North Korean capability is improving, Pyongyang nuclear objectives are defensive in nature.
I don't think it's increased the likelihood that they're going to try to attack us. And I think talk of preventive war is probably aimed at making the North Koreans nervous, but in truth seems to be making everyone but the North Koreans nervous while convincing the North Koreans that they need to go full speed ahead on their nuclear program.
There is a major U.S.-South Korean air exercise underway this week. Is that provocative? North Korea says it is.
Well, North Korea says everything is provocative, but, you know, these are defensive exercises that are aimed at defending South Korea, and that's what we're both there for. So I don't consider it any more provocative than anything else. Provocation, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder.
There is a report that the Pentagon is considering missile defense sites on the West Coast. What do you make of that?
Obviously, North Korea has a lot of artillery, they have a lot of rockets, and they have a lot of shorter-range missiles, Scud missiles and all, that need to be defended against. But I don't think you put defenses against an ICBM in South Korea. I think those have to be a little bit further away, closer to where the target is.
You wrote last week about North Korea and suggested that North Korea's strategy is different from what many U.S. officials are taking as an aggressive move. What exactly is is North Korea up to?
First of all, when it comes to North Korea, we're all guessing. I don't claim to have any great insights into the mind of Kim Jong-un, but I think if all else fails, listen to what they're saying. And what they're saying very consistently is they believe that they need to have the ability to retaliate against the United States with nuclear weapons in order to keep us from attacking them. Now, the fact that the closer they get to that capability, the more likely it is that we might attack them to prevent it is a logic that seems to be lost on them. And I don't think anyone's going to go into Kim Jong-un and say, hey, boss, I think your strategy is screwed up. You know, in the U.S., you get fired for that. In North Korea, you get the firing squad. Big difference. I think that they're very paranoid and they are trying to develop capability that they think will keep them secure.
Ralph Casa said U.S. officials need to be calm and quiet. He said talk of war only makes U.S. allies in the region nervous. He said sanctions are beginning to bite. Casa said whenever he has a chance to speak with North Korean officials, they invariably ask the U.S. to lessen its hostility, and that could begin with easing sanctions. He also said the U.S. needs to sit down with China and figure out a mutually agreeable approach toward North Korea. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Red line for North Korea questioned amid massive war games. Pakistan, Nepal, Myanmar back away from Chinese projects. Indian tycoon calls money laundering accusations baseless. A report says ongoing labor abuse found in Pepsi's Indonesian palm oil plantations. Pakistan's prime minister says nobody wants peace in Afghanistan more than Pakistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau met Chinese Premier Li Keqiang on Monday at the Great Hall of the People in Beijing during a visit to promote trade. Trudeau was accompanied by four cabinet ministers and, along with Keqiang, oversaw the signing of three documents related to trade in food products, energy cooperation, and education, although no details were provided.
I'm pleased that we'll continue our exploratory discussions toward a comprehensive trade agreement between Canada and China. We believe that, done properly, a trade agreement will benefit both countries, creating jobs, strengthening the middle class, and growing our economies.
The Chinese premier said he was open to talks regarding a free trade agreement and mentioned other areas of discussion with the Canadian prime minister.
We also exchanged views on human rights, rule of law, and also other related issues. We both agreed that due to different national circumstances, we may not see eye to eye on some issues, and that is normal. But as long as we act on mutual respect and mutual benefit, then we can seek mutual understanding.
Trudeau will meet with President Xi Jinping later today. Meanwhile, near Paris, the first baby panda in France has a name at last, bestowed by Chinese dignitaries and French First Lady Brigitte Macron. The four-month-old cub has been named Yuan Meng, which means the realization of a wish or accomplishment of a dream. Chinese officials, including Vice Foreign Minister Zhang Jiusui, flew in from Beijing for Monday's naming ceremony at the Beauval Zoo south of Paris.
The Franco-Chinese relationship is entering a new stage of development. The birth of the baby panda is a symbol of the bright prospects of the Franco-Chinese relationship. I express the sincere hope that little Yuan Meng grows up in the best conditions, that he brings happiness to the French people, especially to the French children, and that a new chapter is written in the history of the Franco-Chinese friendship.
The cub's parents are on loan to the zoo from China, and the cub will be sent to a Chinese panda reserve when it's weaned. Tradition holds that panda cubs born in captivity are named by China. Brigitte Macron, considered the panda's godmother, officially announced the name.
Yuan Meng and his parents represent the bond between the countries, which have a lot to share. They are the illustration of an always productive dialogue between our two people, who for centuries look at each other, listen to each other, and understand each other. We have welcomed them in France with pride and happiness.
China, for decades, gifted friendly nations with its unofficial national mascot in what was known as panda diplomacy, and more recently has loaned pandas to zoos on commercial terms. Panda births are closely watched because they remain rare, especially in captivity. Happening now in Asia, North Korea imported 22 million tons of coal worth billions in 2016 from China. But with United Nations sanctions against North Korea in place, a Russian company has now taken over that role. Stay up to date with VOA and VOA 60 online. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always very happy to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us today. The world's largest lithium-ion battery has begun providing electricity into the power grid in South Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports the project is a collaboration between the state government, American firm Tesla, and Nouwen, a French energy company.
Tesla boss Elon Musk, who wasn't in attendance at the switch-on, had boldly promised to build the battery in South Australia within 100 days, a pledge that's been fulfilled. The 100-megawatt battery was officially activated Friday. Musk has said it was three times more powerful than the world's next biggest battery and promised to deliver it for free had it not been built on schedule. The South Australian state government hopes the project can prevent power outages because it can rapidly deploy electricity when it's most needed and reduce prices. Last September, South Australia suffered a statewide power outage when storms damaged the electricity network. State Premier Jay Weatherill believes the new battery will guarantee energy supplies.
People were making fun of South Australia for its leadership in renewable energy and blaming it for the blackout. That, of course, is now being debunked as a myth. We now know that our leadership in renewable energy is not only leading the nation but leading the world. And we're more than happy to supply our beautiful renewable energy stored in a battery to help out the national electricity market.
Located near Jamestown, about 200 kilometres north of Adelaide, the Tesla-built 100-megawatt lithium-ion battery is connected to a wind farm run by French energy company Nouwen. The farm has 99 wind turbines and generates electricity that can be stored in the battery to serve 30,000 people for about an hour. In a statement, the California-based firm said the project in South Australia showed that a sustainable, effective energy solution is possible. Critics of the battery have said the technology's potential has been exaggerated. The bulk of Australia's electricity is still generated by coal, and the nation is one of the world's worst per capita emitters of greenhouse gases. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Researchers based in Singapore say they have built an underwater robot that uses single motors and flexible fins to mimic the appearance and swimming techniques of a manta ray. The underwater robot has many potential uses as they continue to perfect this new design. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, restaurants in Japan and China are now ranked among the best in the world. That's according to the third edition of the French-based La Liste ranking that's being released this week. While French cooking still dominates the top 100 places to eat, the big trend, La Liste co-founder and journalist Jörg Zipprich tells VOA's Victor Beatty, is Chinese haute cuisine found in gourmet restaurants and luxury hotels. The list ranks no fewer than 16,000 eateries worldwide, available in a database and available on a smartphone app. Zipric said Japan and China have always had good restaurants, but they've largely gone unnoticed until now.
You know, when you go to Japan and when you go to China and you're a Westerner, you do not speak the language and you do not know where to look, then you will have a very, very small choice among some selected restaurants. There are restaurants in Japan where you cannot go as an occasional tourist, where even when you are Japanese, you have to be introduced by a regular customer. If not, the gates of these restaurants will be closed forever for you. So it's only we try to find more sources, new sources from inside the country. And the Chinese, for example, have done an admirable job, and which explains why China is going so strong. There is a travel company in China named T-Trip, and excuse me now because my pronunciation is very bad. They have now a restaurant guide called T-Trip Meishilin, which is a good guide. It's well-made and it's well-financed, which is very important for a guide. And, of course, this gives a new view on Chinese restaurants. And this guide is only 2 years old. I'm traveling to China pretty often myself, and I must say that there are amazing restaurants in China which nobody in the West has heard of.
What is China doing right?
You have to create a good restaurant with excellent food, and a good wine or drinks list, local drinks count too, and a good service. You have these all these years under your nose, only that people did not talk about it. In Japan, the situation is slightly different. The best restaurants are often extremely small. These are restaurants for 8 to 10 or 12 people, very upscale places where it's almost like having your private chef and being a very privileged customer. While in China, it's the opposite. Restaurants can be huge. There can be restaurants with 400 customers a day or more. But if you have 400 customers a day, you will have 100 or 200 people in the kitchen.
Are these Chinese and Japanese restaurants, say, in the top 100 of restaurants, or is the scope even larger than that?
There are several ones in the top 100. The ones in the top 100, I think, in China, it's 4. And the ones in the top 100 are really the upscale places where everything is top of the top. What makes the difference between top 100 and top 1,000? La Liste is a ranking system which is on a 100-point scale, and we calculate the 100 points to a quarter point. So it takes really a lot to be in the top 100. And if you only, I will not use the word fail, but if you are a little less good in one of the disciplines, a little less good, not even in cooking, but in service or in your wine list, then you don't make the top 100.
Japan still tops the country table with nearly 140 restaurants in the top 1,000, but here comes China. It's closing the gap with 123. This news alert from VOA Asia. A new report from the Rainforest Action Network says workers at several Indonesian palm oil plantations that supply Pepsi and Nestle are suffering from a variety of labor abuses, including lower than minimum wages, child labor, exposure to pesticides, and union busting. But the RSPO does not offer solutions. Your solution to seeing great stories is to visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a small number of U.S. hospitals are now offering surgery to replace lymph nodes lost in cancer treatment. VOA's Faith Lapidus reports the new nodes are aimed at alleviating pain and discomfort by draining the fluids that cause limbs to swell up.
Felicia Luna prides herself on keeping a spotless house, even the day before she has brain surgery.
Your eye exam went good.
She's at peace with the operation because she has been inside her own brain through virtual reality.
This gives me a clear image of what exactly it looks like and the size of it.
Luna traces the path her neurosurgeon will take to clip her aneurysm and stop its growth.
I was an emotional wreck, but now I feel like I know exactly what's going to happen.
So does the doctor.
But I'll tell you when.
On the eve of the operation, Dr. Gary Steinberg reviews Luna's case to train future surgeons. The Stanford medical students appear as avatars inside her skull.
Kevin, can you see what I'm pointing at? What is that? That's the cella, and what's this here?
Steinberg leads them through Luna's brain, explaining his strategy.
So now we're going to go through into the craniotomy site.
It's also a rehearsal for him as he travels through the brain in 360 degrees.
So we can see the back of the aneurysm, the side. We can see its relationship to the parent vessel that it arises. This is something we could never do before.
The next day, monitors in the operating room display the same 3D images for Luna's actual surgery. Contrast dye makes the vessels appear in CT scans and angiograms, which are then reconstructed into the VR program.
Can you flip this?
Dr. Steinberg does these VR surgeries one or two every week, but he foresees a future where he's not even in the operating room.
He thinks someday he'll operate remotely with robotic arms, but the lag time makes that impossible now. Dr. Steinberg makes a final VR confirmation.
I'm simulating drilling away the bone that's overlying the aneurysm.
Minutes later, he starts the real operation in what's now familiar territory. For now, Stanford uses this VR technology for brain and spine cases. There is no extra charge for the use of VR. Donors and the department pay the fee. Doctors say the more complicated the anatomy, the more useful the technique.
That's good. Thank you.
Luna's surgery is successful. After all, Dr. Steinberg has accomplished it many times before, virtually. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Stanford, California.
Okay, now the other way. Keep going. Yeah, that's it. That's what I need. So that's the clinoid. Push it up this way a little. Yeah. Okay, now fade away the bone.
There are some amazing health stories at voanews.com that you can not only read about, but also see. Some wonderful video to go with them. Fascinating stuff. Check it out. For individuals, storing information in the cloud means it can be available to them anywhere that they have a connection to the internet. That, of course, can be cheap and useful, but because all that data is going back and forth, it's not quite as secure as storing everything on your phone or your home computer. But what if you could wear your information? VOA's Kevin Enix has discovered that's the idea behind some National Science Foundation-supported research into cloud clothing.
Raqib Hassan is putting on all his data in the form of a personal cloud.
I think personal clouds, clouds that are highly mobile, clouds you can take with you wherever you want or wherever you go, that's the way to go in future.
Cloud computing allows users to store their information on remote computers instead of personal computers. Cloud storage protects against crashes and allows access to the data anywhere there's an internet connection. But those giant banks of servers are a tempting target for hackers. So Hassan is working on creating clouds that stay with you.
Part of my research focuses on how we can make clouds out of our local things.
Like this prototype cloud jacket with 10 tiny computers, a personal Wi-Fi hotspot, extra batteries, and even a solar panel for recharging.
We're working on a kind of like a vest that you can attach to the insides of any type of clothing. So if you want to make a shirt smart, just put the vest inside that shirt, it'll become smart. If you want to make a dress smart, that can be also be done.
The applications are as numerous as the imagination, from smart bracelets that act as personnel alert systems to smart hospital gowns that can monitor a patient's health, and military equipment that keeps track of real-time battlefield and search and rescue missions.
They might need a lot of image processing or computing capability as they look for survivors using their different devices. If some of the first responders are wearing jackets like this, they can offload the heavy data processing or data crunching to the jacket itself.
The security factor is increased because the cloud isn't on some faraway server farm, it's on your body.
My goal is to put the user in charge. The user should be able to control what happens to the data. And in today's cloud, that's the vital part that's missing.
Hassan is working to make his gear more user-friendly. He envisions a future where smartphones, watches, and Fitbits all work together, connected by the shirt on your back. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
I guess since we're online, that means you could wear VOA Asia if you like. My, you look fashionable today. Well, we thank you at least for listening to our program. You can get it on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can find us at VOA Asia Facebook, which streams our program each and every day, as well as our website, voanews.com. And of course, we want to hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook, a great place to send us a message, along with our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Our thanks go out to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Jimmy Cook, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a wonderful day.